Good morning. I'm speaking with Marianne Trasciati, Director of Labor Studies and Professor of Rhetoric and Public Advocacy at Hofstra University. She studies the role of public protest in social advocacy and building community and the rhetoric of early 20th century anti-capitalist radicals. She's the author of numerous publications, including the books Talking to the Girls, Intimate and Political Essays on the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire, and most recently, Where Are the Workers? Labor's Stories at Museums and Historic Sites. Welcome to KBOO, Marianne Trasciati.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, Marianne, today capitalism is so embedded in the U.S. and global political economy that even many social movements, such as climate and racial justice movements, fail to critique it. But in the early 20th century, all kinds of movements were active in opposing capitalism. You're working on a book about Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, the rebel girl. And here in the Pacific Northwest, she's known as the quintessential radical for her activism with the industrial workers of the world. What attracted you to Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, and why is there a need for an updated biography?
Oh my gosh, who could not be attracted to Elizabeth Gurley Flynn? She was whip smart, she was brave and audacious. I mean, she really had moxie. She was beautiful, she was young when she made her debut as an activist in public space. She was, 15 years old on a soapbox or reading about women and socialism. And she devoted her whole life to that cause, to the cause of the emancipation of the working class from wage slavery, as it was known in the early 20th century. I mean, when she first started her career with the IWW, the goal was actually abolition of the wage system and capitalism and ownership of the means of production by workers. And that seems kind of far-fetched perhaps now, when people are looking for a fair day's wage for a fair day's work. But to these early 20th century capitalists, Flynn and others in the IWW, the wage system was really oppressive. There was a significant step, but not a large step, between chattel slavery and wage slavery in their eyes. People did not control their own destinies, and she really devoted her life to trying to change that situation. So I think she has a lot to teach us about organizing, and particularly working class organizing.
Well, one of the things that she is able to teach us is about how to organize more broadly. And she was a linchpin between liberals and radicals in the 1920s at the height of repression against workers. So why did she reach out to others to organize on behalf of workers?
Well, she started her public career as a socialist and then joined the IWW. And she was good friends with James Connolly, the Irish socialist, and her parents were socialists. From an early age, she understood that capitalism was an oppressive system and that working people of all kinds around the world needed to join together to fight back against this oppressive system. So I think one of the things that she teaches us is that we need to build coalitions among immigrant workers, American-born workers, Black, white, male, female, migratory, more stationary workers, but also that we need to build ideological coalitions, right? The left radical labor organizers have a habit of devouring their own movements, generally speaking, right? I'm an anarchist, you're a communist, he's a socialist, and, we have more that divides us than unites us. And in fact, that's not true. And Flynn was really good at looking for the points of commonality that would unite labor activists, particularly on the left. But also she did her best to be inclusive of more mainstream organizations, too, like the American Federation of Labor. And again, she would focus on the things that activists had in common rather than the things that divided them. She wasn't a theorist, right? She didn't dwell very often or very comfortably in the realm of theory. So she wasn't interested in, Marx versus Bakunin or things like that. She was really interested in what happens on the ground, in the factory, or, out in the woods where lumber workers are working, or in the restaurants where waiters and cooks are working. And how can we bring people together to make life better for these people? What do we share? And in the 1920s, she was, I think, at the height of her organizing ability in that regard, right? She was a founding member of the ACLU, but she also worked very closely with anarchists advocating for the release of Sacco and Vanzetti, for example. So bridging the liberal establishment, so to speak, people who had their hearts in the right place, who really cared about what was going on with workers, but had absolutely no understanding of what life was like for immigrant Italians like Sacco and Vanzetti. So she was able to translate the experiences of working people into a language that more well-heeled liberals could understand and care about, and to bring everybody together again over like what unites us. We want to save these guys from the electric chair, right? I'm using the Sacco and Vanzetti case as an example because I think it really does illustrate her. I don't think it's an overstatement to say her brilliance at pulling people together. What we want is to save Sacco and Vanzetti. Who cares whether we're anarchists, communists, Italians, liberals, members of the AFL? These are working men who are being railroaded for being working at class advocates. And we want to save them. And that's what unites us. And I will say something that probably sounds a little counterintuitive. I think the fact that she was such a skilled orator, again, I told you she made her debut as an activist on a soapbox giving a speech in New York. And she was a champion debater. And as an orator and a debater, she was very sensitive to audience. So she understood and she retained this sensitivity throughout her activist career. What kinds of messages tend to unite people rather than divide them? What kinds of slogans can we all rally around? How can I make this story accessible to people who at first blush might not be inclined to embrace it? So she was really sensitive to how you reach people, how you get them to think, but also get them to feel, and how you bridge divisions of race, ethnicity, gender, but also ideology.
Well, as you point out, we probably wouldn't know as much about Sacco and Vanzetti had it not been for Elizabeth Gurley Flynn's organizing brilliance. But let's shift here to this importance of using public spaces for telling labor's stories. And you recently commented on the monument to Elizabeth Gurley Flynn that was erected in New Hampshire, her birthplace, and how officials removed the monument. But you had a few comments to make about what was inscribed on that monument.
Yeah, so Flynn started her career as a Wobbly. Then she left the Wobblies for a while and really devoted herself to civil liberties advocacy. And I would argue that she is one of the most important figures in the history of the civil liberties movement in the U.S. And that's one of my goals in the book, is to really convince people of that. And she dropped out of public life for about a decade. She had some personal issues, health issues in her life, and then came back during the Popular Front period when she joined the Communist Party of the United States. And she remained a communist from when she joined the party in 37 until she died in 1964. And she endured a lot of criticism from old friends, old Wobblies, liberals, etc., who couldn't quite understand why she became a communist. And of course, she suffered the repression that came with the second Red Scare and the Cold War and the McCarthy period. She was arrested and imprisoned under the Smith Act. She had her passport revoked. I mean, she suffered, right, all of the implications of that. She was a communist. She thought of herself as a communist. She was an activist in what she called the working class movement from the age of 15 till she died in 1964 at the age of 74. And this plaque was removed because of that, right? That because she was a working class activist and a member of the Communist Party, public officials in the state of New Hampshire, it was erected at her birthplace, right, decided that these kind of people do not deserve to be remembered in public space. But interestingly, the people who designed the plaque emphasized, I mean, they acknowledged that she was a working class activist. They acknowledged that she'd been arrested under the Smith Act. But they also tried to frame her as something different than the Flynn that I described to you, that she was a feminist. She was a suffrage activist and a birth control activist. And that would not have rung true to Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, or in fact, to people who knew her in her lifetime. As a member of the party, she was often asked to speak to women about women's issues, and she understood that it was important to organize women for the struggle, but it was the struggle that was important to her. She did not advocate for suffrage as a member of the ACLU. The ACLU was founded in 1920 after the federal suffrage amendment had been passed. In fact, she didn't vote. She thought voting was a kind of an abstract right that was removed from the lives of most working class women. You know, when you're on the picket line, when your family is starving because your wages are barely enough to keep them above water, you're going to tell women, go vote, and maybe you'll end up electing somebody to office who will change things during the next legislative session. She thought that was absurd. She didn't vote until the 30s when she voted for Fiorella LaGuardia and Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, right? And she even notes in her autobiographical notes in the archives. I ceased being a wobbly today. I voted for the first time. And then you have things like the Washington Post referring to her as a feminist with a communist past, as if like, we want to remember this feminist, but because she became a communist, it's difficult to honor her important work on behalf of feminism. But again, that's not who she was. She was a communist without modification. She was a class warrior. And I think if we're going to remember her, let's remember her as she was, not as we try to reframe her into being to suit whatever it is we want to emphasize rather than what she herself found important.
And that may be the Washington Post and New York Times embracing a new Cold War anti-communism in the ways that they're demonizing Russia and China and any Americans who criticize U.S. foreign policy today. Well, let's talk some more, Marianne, about the importance of commemorating labor history. And let me just say that this is Lori Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio. I'm speaking with Marianne Trasciati about early 20th century labor radicals and what they have to tell us about labor struggles today. So, Marianne, you've headed this effort in New York to commemorate the 1911 Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire and the resulting movement for workers' rights and safety. Why is it so important to tell the stories of workers in public spaces?
Oh, well, because those are our stories, right? I mean, the one thing that most of us share is that we work for a living within the wage system of late stage capitalism at this point in history, right? So these are the stories that have the potential to unite us across all kinds of barriers that often threaten to divide us, right? Ideological, racial, gender, ethnicity, language, et cetera. So labor stories are stories of all of us. So that's really important. And it's also important, I think, to recognize that the things that make life worth living in the United States today, things like, you know, paid time off, social security, workers' compensation, these are not things that were given to working people by benevolent governments or benevolent employers. These are things that working people fought tooth and nail, sometimes at the cost of their lives, sometimes unwillingly giving their lives, right? Unknowingly, as with the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. And we need to honor their struggles. We need to honor what they have done to help us, those of us who have achieved a standard of living, what sometimes gets labeled a middle-class standard of living, but that this is something that was hard fought for and every battle was a struggle. So I think that that's one important reason to do this work. We also know that when people learn these stories, they're inspired to hear about the struggles of their ancestors. You know, I will tell the story of the Triangle Fire to public audiences, and people will raise their hands and tell me about their immigrant grandmother who was in the ILGWU, or their, you know, their immigrant grandfather or great uncle who was a tailor, somebody, you know, who was an organizer for the Amalgamated Clothing Workers. And they tap into their own history. And that's a really powerful, powerful experience, because then they start to see their personal history reflected in the contemporary struggles of working people. And we don't get this history, for the most part, in school. Depending on the state you live, if you live in Massachusetts, if you live in New York, if you live in California, you will get some of these stories because they're mandated by the state. If you live in Texas, that's not happening. If you live in Florida, that's not happening, right?
Yeah. And I would say, Marianne, that this is what I appreciate so much about your book that is just recently out, co-edited, Where Are the Workers? Labor Stories at Museums and Historic Sites, is that it focuses on unlikely places, especially in red states, where labor history can be explored and taught and commemorated. I mean, in many ways, the book serves as a blueprint for organizing and how to reach out to people who know nothing about their working class history or labor struggles. I'm thinking of the essay in the book about the Southern Tenant Farmers Union in Arkansas and how even in Arkansas, people can tell these stories in ways that really do reach out in new ways to the white working class in particular.
Oh, absolutely. And Rob Linnet's essay on murals in Texas, I think, illustrates how we can take things, even things that aren't explicitly intended as public labor history initiatives, and we can teach them and tease out the lessons that they have about the history of the struggles of working people in the United States. So sure. And we know that people respond to these things. There's evidence that people place a high degree of trust in the people and the stories that they encounter at museums and other history sites. and that they enjoy hearing these stories. Because again, these are their stories, particularly when they're local initiatives. There are essays in the book about the Lorry Mill, about Gastonia, right? You go there and you recall people in your family who work there. We see that with Triangle too. Like people come and, oh, you know, I have relatives. They come to the commemoration at the Brown Building every year where the fire happened. And, oh, I have relatives who worked in the garment industry. This is so important. This is so special. Thank you for speaking to my history. And it's great. And it's important. And we need to do more of it. And I will just add one more thing. It's also difficult for those stories to be co-opted. What I love about Eric Loomis's essay on the National Park Service in the book is that he talks about that. That part of the reason why we have to fight so hard to tell these stories is because it's really hard to spin them into the triumphalist narrative, right? Oh yeah, we used to have these problems, but we've overcome them. No, we haven't overcome them. And in fact, in many cases, we didn't deal well with them in the past either. So it's a challenge, right, to people who want to say everything is beautiful and nothing hurts. And so I think we need to do more of this work. And I applaud, Lorry, the work that you do and that public historians in general are doing around this and lots of other issues.
Well, Marianne Trasciati, thank you so much for joining us to share these stories and more about your work and the connections of past to present.
Oh, thank you.